This is Digital Music Trends 166 on the 15th of January 2014. This week on the show, the latest US streaming numbers. Then we talk about Pandora, Mixcloud, Wide, the value of curation and of playlists, Samsung and Deezer's talks, and much more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Linelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and video podcast on a variety of channels, including iTunes, most podcatchers, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Spreaker, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio and Audioboo. And to get in touch with the show, you can tweet us on @DigiMusicTrends or email us on contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. And on DigitalMusicTrends.com, there's also a voluntary subscription option right now. So if you tune in every week and would like to contribute to the running of the show, you can go and take a look on the site and it's on the right-hand side of the screen. And thanks so much to those who have already signed up, actually. And this week on the show, it's a real pleasure to welcome two fantastic new guests. So first up, Andrew Dubber, Professor of Music Industries Innovation at Birmingham City University and also author of the book Radio in the Digital Age, as well as organizer of Music Tech Fest, too. So hi, Andrew, and great to have you on. How's it going?
Oh, it's going very well. Thanks very much for having me, Andrea.
It's great to have you for the first time. I can't believe it's taken so long. And then we have Camille Ainsworth from digital marketing and PR agency Charm Factory. So hi, Camille, and great to have you on.
Hello, how are you?
Absolutely fine. Yeah, it's a good day. It's a busy day, but that's also good. Today, I would like to start with a follow-up from last week's show, actually, where we talked about the BPI and Nielsen figures for UK and US recorded music sales. A couple of days after we recorded the show, Nielsen actually released the official numbers for 2013, which included the all-important streaming data. So overall, music streams were up 32%, and these include RDO, Spotify, YouTube, /Vivo, Zune, Cricket, and MediaNet. If we look at on-demand audio streaming services alone, that figure is even higher with an increase of 103% over 2012. So as we mentioned last week, digital track sales were down in both the US and the UK, signaling perhaps that they reached a peak in 2012 and that from 2013 onwards, we're going to see a decline on that side, which is might be proportional to the increase of prominence for streaming services. So first of all, did you think that this was going to happen quite as fast as it did? Andrea, do you have any thoughts on that? And were you surprised to see this decline right away from 2013 and such an increase in streaming as well?
I have to be perfectly honest. I pay almost no attention whatsoever to statistics like that, mostly because there is nothing that you can glean from trends like this.
Yeah.
If something declines by 10% in 1 year from 1 year to another, or increases by 20% from 1 year to another, that's no predictor of the following year. I mean, one of the pieces of statistics I think that came out a couple of years back was that, the headline was something along the lines of the British music industry has seen an upsurge of X% of music sales in that particular year. And you look at the data closely enough and you go, no, Adele released a record. And really, once you start getting outliers like that, where people are behaving in a particular way because of things that are not to do with mass movements of people or mass trends, I mean, people are acting individually. That's one of the things to bear in mind. And these things are always far more complex than they appear. So aggregated numbers in my world basically mean nothing. And so that any kind of knowledge that you can get from that, and also that they don't tell you anything useful, because if, for instance, I run an independent record label and I have things on Spotify and I have things on Deezer and I have things on, you know, all these different services, knowing that more people streamed this year than last year doesn't tell me to do anything. There's no kind of extra information or actionable knowledge that can result from that. It's interesting to know from a macroeconomics perspective, and I guess if you've got data that goes back 10 or 15 years, once these sort of things are tracked over time, you can get some kind of relevant historical perspective on what's happened.
Yeah.
But actually predicting is something you shouldn't try to do in the first place. I mean, you should try and create the conditions for your success, but also trying to kind of choose your behaviors based on what you think everybody out there is doing. It's kind of nonsense because everybody is doing all sorts of different stuff, and that aggregates to these kind of numbers and shifts, if that makes sense.
Sure, absolutely. Camille, what are your thoughts on this? Do you agree with Andrew that we can't really glean much from the data? That's definitely an interesting and refreshing perspective on his end.
Definitely to some extent. When I think about it, for music, it's true. It's about things like... what's been released, what people want to listen to, just the quality of what people are actually even putting out. And that has to go across all creative industries about what you're going to, that when you're talking about who's buying what and why.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you made the point about whether or not you can actually tell anything about what you should go and do from an increase in numbers. And I think you actually can. You can make a decision on whether or not you focus your resources on that or not. And I think that is what labels are doing. One of the reasons why it's probably grown last year is because labels have gone away and have had people looking at how to increase people listening on Spotify and listening on Deezer. And that's just probably one of the latest things that have come into their remit, really, to do. I guess it shows that they've had some success.
Yeah, and you think that also influences the strategy and the digital strategy of labels?
It definitely does. It definitely does. And we see it here. So people are going to be putting in follow links to Spotify profiles, and they are going to continue to try and cultivate a community around that point of sale kind of element where they're actually going to be profiting from people listening. So yeah
sure, that's interesting, and definitely we're going to keep an eye on these numbers, and we're going to report on the IFPI as well, and what they usually come up with as a worldwide sort of stats for the year, and looking at past couple of years as well, and see what's happening on that front. And I want to talk a little bit about startups, because I like talking about startups as well, and we all know it's a tough world out there, but thankfully there's still some funding to go around, as French-based music service Wide has closed around for 700 in seed funding to further its goal to become the service people use to save and collect the music they discover on the web. And there's a few companies that do similar type of things as well, of course, but they Wide especially allow people to collect music from disparate sources like Spotify, YouTube, Deezer, and different blogs. So a Panda Daily article likens it to an Instapaper for audio, which is not a bad analogy really for the service. And this is one of my personal favorite subjects, which has to do with pooling together your experiences online to find a way to gather them all together and remedy the problem of data fragmentation. So, we can actually start talking about Music Tech Fest with Andrew in a second. But as far as Wide is concerned and being able to gather that data, Camille, do you think that there's one company can solve that problem, or are people too sort of jumpy? Do they jump from service to another too much for them to actually stick around with one particular company that does this type of aggregation for a long time?
I think people will commit to one. I personally, it's not in my character to do that. I will jump around and try new things, but I think other people will stick to one service because it's, people don't really like a lot of change if they can avoid it. I like the idea of them pairing people with similar music tastes, and that's really positive. I think the biggest issue that they all face is marketing. Yeah. They don't really know how to market it very well and actually make themselves stand out from the other services. And also sometimes they get a bit carried away with what I see as more like gimmicks. So even with Soundwave, with all the backing that it's had and all the fancy PR that it had, actually I don't really care who else in Camden is listening to it and what they're listening to. I don't see how that's relevant to me. But maybe that is me, and I'm quite particular and I think about that kind of thing. But realistically, they've got to think about what's going to really benefit the user and how they're going to market it. And it's the same with all these services. They don't often think about what the actual final end user, which is the music fan, what they need enough. There's so much focus on the industry and on what technology can do. There's not enough focus on actually thinking about what people need it to do and what will make their lives better.
Andrea, do you feel like this kind of startup can take off in today's world? And I'm sure you're seeing a lot of different concepts as well as you're working with the Music Tech Fest at the moment as well.
Yeah, there's like you say, a lot of movement in this area, and there are a lot of people who are trying kind of a bunch of different takes on this. I happen to like Songdrop as an example of these sorts of aggregation of things that I can find online, but I can listen to in my way. And I love the story of the origin of Songdrop, because it's a bunch of people who got together and said, we want something for us that we're just going to make in our spare time. And then, wait a minute, we have a product here. Yeah. But the idea of this kind of perpetual growth fetish that a lot of startups have is not just we want to make something useful that is sustainable and that we can make a business out of. We have to take over the world, and we have to be sold to a billion for Facebook. I'm hoping that's starting to go away, that people are trying to make things that kind of sustainable businesses, not just kind of the bubble mentality of we have to make something that's enormous. Wired could be successful as anything with me never having heard of it, and that would be absolutely fine. It doesn't have to be one of these things that everybody uses. But if it fits into somebody's lifestyle and it fits into how somebody likes to consume music, then great. And if they can make a business out of that and they can make a model out of that, that's kind of the sustainability ethic that I'm really trying to push in this sphere. Yeah. But like you say, with Music Tech Fest, we're dealing with so many. I mean, you would just not believe how many music industry startups there are on the planet right now. And
I have some idea. I try and do one interview a week with some of them. So
yeah, you'll be here for the rest of your life if you just deal with who's operating now. But the interesting thing is, so many of them have this winner takes all mentality about it, that we have to be the biggest and we have to be the best. And actually, once you sort of get them all in a room together and working with hackers and technologists and musicians and the rest of it, the realization when you're confronted with just how much is out there, it's like a novelist who wants to write the one big bestseller, or it's not worth, you know, starting to type. You start to realize, actually, no, I can just be useful and I can contribute and I can have a sustainable business in this field. And that's actually, I think it's a lot more healthy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key word, sustainable, that you say there, because some of the concepts that we are seeing that I'm seeing proposed, it feels like they could only work at scale, just because otherwise the financials wouldn't stack up. Is that your feeling as well?
Well, that's the problem of venture capital, which is, you know, we've put a lot of money into this. You have to make us a lot of money. It has to be enormous. Or why did we even have a meeting in the first place? Yeah. And I think that what I'm seeing, which is really kind of encouraging, is there's lots of bootstrapping going on in this space now. There's lots of people who are going, yeah, we don't need to be 30% owned by a venture capitalist we don't need first-class flights to San Francisco to have meetings, and we don't need all of those things. We can actually just get in a room and we can code things. I mean, one of my favorite stories, I'm on the board of advisors for Bandcamp. Yeah. And one of the things I love about Bandcamp is they spent the first, I don't know, 18 months, their office was a local public library, and they all sat around, brought their laptops and a cup of coffee, and they sat around and they worked. And until they were at the point of sustainability, they didn't need premises, and they worked on IRC, they had people in a couple of different countries, but it was this idea of, no, we're just going to build it, and we're going to make it useful, and we're going to make it good. And I think I really admire that kind of approach to the startup sector.
Yeah, sure. Camille, do you agree that there might be space here for also companies that are not necessarily huge, but that are sustainable in this space as well?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are starting these businesses without much of a business model, or because they quite fancy what they think the lifestyle is, and they come in here and we have meetings with them, and it's terrifying. I think there will be more services that are going to be smaller and just more sensible, really, I think is probably the key, because they are a creative industry, and in creative industries, no one ever thinks that big. I mean, it's almost a similar problem to what people have, what the bands have in music. They think, they see people getting really big and then thinking, oh, well, I can do that. I'm really good. And it just doesn't always work out. And there is an element of luck, and there is an element of people being really, really well prepared and skills. And I think that's probably the situation right now.
Absolutely not. It makes a lot of sense, sure. And Andrew, you were talking about Music Tech Fest. So can you tell us a little bit about what's happening with that, and what are the news, really?
Well, you picked a good day to ask me that on, because we've just had a couple of really interesting things confirmed. Music Tech Fest has been happening in London for the last 2 years, and it's an event where we bring together the music industry, we bring together music tech startups, we bring together hackers, musicians, artists, all sorts of people in that space, and put them in a room together, and people show what they do. It's kind of, I guess you'd think of it halfway between TED Talks with performance and a hack event and all of these things kind of rolled in together. Yeah. But it's a really interesting collaborative space. We're taking it worldwide this year. I've just sort of come on board as festival director. We've just confirmed we're doing Wellington in New Zealand at the end of February. We're going to Microsoft Research Labs in Boston at the end of March. We're doing the Barbican in May. Then we're going to LA in July, and then Brazil in September, and we've got a whole bunch
That's cool.
Yeah, so we've got a bunch of other places that have come to us and go, can you do a Music Tech Fest here? That sounds really interesting. And the cool thing about it for me is, because I went to last year's Music Tech Fest.
Yeah, me too. It was great.
Well, I got really excited about it, and I've ended up kind of organizing it. And one of the exciting things for me is there isn't really anything like this, which, A, it's not incredibly prohibitively expensive to go to. It's been free in recent years, and we're going to, I think we're looking at something like a 10 quid nominal entry fee for people who just want to attend. But it's a space in which we can put together people who are doing the latest academic research at PhD level and put them in the same room with music industry people and go, look, this is actually useful to you. You can invent new stuff. You can create the future of the music industry. You don't have to predict it or wait for it to happen to you, which is, you know, what the point I was making earlier about statistics, which is this kind of reactive approach to music industry innovation. I really like the kind of, well, let's just get our hands dirty and build something and see what happens if we do that. And so some of the collaborations that have come out of Music Tech Fest in the past have been really, really powerful. But now that we're sort of taking this model and this concept to the world, I think that we're starting to really build up some momentum in terms of brands getting involved and just sort of people seeing the real potential of what happens if we give this group of people our mobile devices or our sneakers that we want to sell or these sorts of things. What can they build out of them and what can we associate with music? And I think that's a really exciting space to be in right now.
That's awesome. And the website to go on is musictechfest.org. Obviously, you can go and check that out and see all the events that are happening as they roll in. And Camille, while we're working on plugs sort of halfway through the show, I wanted to ask you about Charm Factory. So what do you guys do and how should people get in touch if they want to look into working with you?
Well, we're a PR and marketing agency for bands, artists, musicians, and also we work with brands. We work across majors and independents, so everyone at the moment from John Newman to a band called Dahlia, who are quite new, and we do also their social management as well. So we'll work on everyone's profiles and putting together a strategy so that a campaign feeds in well to what's happening actually in the rest of the PR.
Yeah.
You can find out more about us on our roster at charmfactory.co.uk.
Great. Awesome.
And all our contact details are there.
That's great, thanks. So again, it's charmfactory.co.uk. And I wanted to move on actually by talking about radio, and today there's actually quite a big radio heavy lineup, which is good because Andrew has actually written a book on radio, so it's definitely good to have you on.
And I
used to be working radio, so perfect. Perfect panel to have on today. And so I want to start with Pandora. So the co-founders, Tim Westergren and Tom Conrad, gave a two-hour interview at Pando Daily, which the fireside chats of Pando Daily at CES in Las Vegas. So the video is available online. I'll throw a link in the show notes, and it's definitely worth the 2 hours of your time if you're interested in knowing more about Pandora's backstory. You can keep it running in the background. It's definitely quite interesting if you're doing something not particularly interesting at work. They elaborate on the current controversies around payments surrounding not just Pandora, but on-demand services like Spotify as well. And Westergren believes that the industry has to rebuild itself on a new premise, one that starts with an acceptance that commerce is more challenging when people pay a dollar for a product than the original $20 that were charged for an album back in the day. So of course, they are quite bullish because the company is doing really well. In December they had like some fantastic stats on listeners, and the stock jumped 14% just in one day. It's all-time highs, so the company appears to be holding up really well, even given the threat of other services coming into play. And so I wanted to ask you, first of all, a generic question that comprises both the US, UK, European market. How do you see internet radio moving forward, Andrew, as far as trying to balance the payments with the sustainability of the companies, with the artist requests that are, of course, very legitimate?
Well, the first thing to clarify, when you say Pandora, we're considering that to be radio online, because that's the first question that I would ask, is the extent to which that's a useful metaphor for something that actually does very little to do with what radio has traditionally done. It's transmitted in a different way, it's organized in a different way, the people who work in it do different, completely different jobs, how people listen to it is different. So I kind of like to distinguish radio from the streaming music services.
That's very interesting, actually, because I've been at panels where actually people were defining everything as radio. So yeah, it's definitely interesting to hear you say that.
I spend the first two chapters of my book going, well, it's complicated. And I think it is. And I think it's important that it's complicated and that we actually ask really – I mean, it seems like arguing about semantics, but actually it's really important when you think about what is this like, because actually it's not like anything that we've had before. And so we need to approach it on its own terms. And that's important when it comes to things like organizing who should pay whom and for what. Because if you're using an older model for going, well, radio pays us this much, you go, well, yes, but this isn't radio and this works in a different way. And that might mean that Pandora should pay more. It might mean they should pay less. It might mean that that record labels should be paying artists at a different rate than they currently are for things that they're, you know, not actively using for promotion. All of these sorts of questions are up for grabs. And I think if you go, well, it's just radio on the internet, it shuts down a lot of interesting questions about, now, what is this actually doing? Where is the value created? How should the money move in order for that to happen? Yeah. And actually quite a lot of the time, who should pay who money is the least interesting bit of that conversation in terms of, you know, what does this mean for people and how does it change their relationship with music? What can we do with it once we've got it? Can you use it for promotion? Or is this, you know, I mean, it's all these sorts of questions. Because if you're talking about Pandora, for instance, somebody is choosing that music or an algorithm is choosing that music based on things that you've selected. There isn't a promotional channel that's going through that. There isn't a program director who's selecting a playlist who's going, you know, here is a meal, you eat it. So the kind of the value in all sorts of ways, culturally and economically, get moved around a whole lot. So I think it's one of those things that you need to start from first principles and not just go, it's not fair, somebody needs to pay me more money, but actually make a case for, well, this is the value we create, this is the chain of value, and here is where we can make this sustainable or not sustainable. I mean, people can pick their toys and go home, as, you know, Tom York's done from Spotify, for instance. Yeah. But you need to actually kind of understand the medium on its own terms before you start doing that.
Yeah, sure. Camille, do you feel like, I'm quite interested in the UK market as well. Do you feel like in the UK we could see a model, a Pandora-like startup take off? I know there are some issues around rates, but, you know, do you think that here we have a different culture and people are still used to the mainstream Radio 2s and Radio 1s of this world?
Definitely. You know, we've got the BBC, and those are very, very strong audiences, the very large audiences, and it's really good quality. So I think it's going to be completely different. In America, they had things like Jack FM that came in and they tried to launch it in the UK and it just didn't work at all. Yeah. And that was the network of radio where they didn't have any presenters. And it was huge in America. So you've got a very different kind of radio industry over here. In online, you're right, it's really, really clouded because you have got these services that are just effectively just the computer telling you what to listen to. Yeah. But then you do also have people, you know, student radio stations are increasingly just online and they're great fun. And it's not the best quality radio, but it's actually is structured in the same way as the BBC might structure or that one of the global brands might structure their station. So it's yeah. It is about thinking about the amount of work that goes into it. And listeners, and it's a really complicated area.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ofcom have often said in the UK that they don't want to deal with online radio, basically. They don't want to regulate it. That might have changed recently. It's been a while since I've worked in radio, but that was because they realised just how murky it was and actually how difficult it is to police. Yeah. And when it's open up to being all over the world as well,
yeah.
Being online, it gets very, very tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. And another company that I'm really attached to because I've known them since they launched that I want to talk about was Mixcloud, because they launched a brand new website today, actually, that is sort of called the Mixcloud X project, because it's a complete overhaul of the design of their homepage on the web, which actually reflects the updated design that they gave their iOS and Android app and also they added functionality in there as well. So now there's a queuing system that's been added, so you can actually queue the shows that you want to listen to on Mixcloud. And the company has got some really impressive numbers. It now has over 500,000 content creators that are uploading content to the platform. It's got loads of long form content from DJ mixes to radio shows to all sorts of stuff on there, really. And it's really interesting to see how it's grown, as you were mentioning, Andrew, as a bootstrap company as well that didn't really take in any massive VC funding over the past 5 years, really. So, I'm quite excited about it, and I really hope that they keep growing. Andrew, what is your take on Mixcloud, and do you think they can keep expanding the way they have?
I don't know if they can keep expanding the way they have. I think that that's nice that they're going through incremental change. Yeah. And I think there's lots of room for them to do more and more interesting things too. But I've been a big fan of Mixcloud since they started. And I'm one of these people that sort of uploads mixes to it and also radio programs that I've made. I mean, it's currently my archive for radio programs that I made a decade ago. And it means that when I want to kind of revisit them or point something towards them, I've got a URL that I can simply do that to. And I think that Nickel from Mixcloud is quite keen to get more radio content, more sort of radiophonic content, I guess, mixes of spoken word and music or interview-based stuff, because it is very much known as a DJ mix platform.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot more potential to it than that. I mean, if people started thinking of it as, a way of doing long-form spoken word stuff or that kind of radio program production mentality to make something and present it on the web as a finished thing. I think Mixcloud is a really good platform for that, particularly if they give us lots of alternatives for embedding. Because yeah. one of the problems I always had with Mixcloud was this sort of square embed thing, which was a picture that had a playlist behind it. And I'd like to sort of have a little bit more kind of flexibility about that. And hopefully, I haven't seen the new redesign today, but hopefully there's an element of that in the mix as well.
Yeah. Camille, have you used Mixcloud in your work as well? And do you feel like artists can use a platform like that if they produce mixes, to really gather an audience and make the most out of that, you know, that talent of mixing? And it's not actually easy to find platforms where you can put fully finished mixes up and they're going to stay up, because most of the time they get taken down.
Yeah. It's good. It's definitely favorable in that sense that they actually pay licenses. We actually find that generally the artists that we work with, they don't have enough time to do regular mixes that they might put it up there and create a following. Certainly if we're doing our job right and they're getting more and more popular, they're going to have less and less time, and they don't really want to have to think about doing that. Quite often we'll take a playlist or a mix and it will be used multiple times in different areas and things like that.
Sure.
I think there are probably better areas for them to use that kind of content.
Yeah.
If not for a third-party site, media site, or on their Spotify or something like that, there are different places where they can use it.
Yeah.
So it's not been something we use regularly, no. And I do think it's been used for some competitions and things in the past. I wasn't involved in that. But I do think they're a really good team, but I would be wondering about how they're going to grow it more.
Yeah.
Like, I've never really worked out how they made any kind of revenue, really. But I've not spent a lot of time looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, Mixcloud is always an interesting story, because I'm sure I talked about this before on the show, but they've always been able to create brand partnerships that enable the site to generate enough revenue to keep it running and to keep it growing sort of at a reasonable rate. I think it's still under 15 or 20 people, the team right now, and they've sort of slowly expanded over the years. So I think they've always managed to sort of keep the platform running on the money that they generated through brand sponsorship. So that's an interesting thing.
It's, yeah.
it's pretty cool of them.
I'm not sure, from our point of view, what they really give to brands that is going to keep brands coming back to them, I think.
Yeah.
We think, like, I've met the team, they're really great. They've got a lot of great ideas. There's something in it, but I just don't know how, if we were talking to a brand, how we would justify it and how malleable it would be to be in a campaign.
Yeah. And finally, Camille, I know you have to run in a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to ask you about the latest additions to SoundCloud. So SoundCloud unveiled a few new features on its messaging service system within the platform. So this comes on the heels of some changes that were made by Twitter that made its direct DMs more prominent within the Twitter platform, and also Instagram that introduced the opportunity to share images privately. And SoundCloud hadn't really done a lot of work on its direct messaging platform for a long time, but the update actually makes it a lot sleeker. It looks really nice, like a sort of a fancy web email client almost. You can actually embed tracks as links, but they come up as little widgets now. You know, you can actually message tracks directly from the share button on SoundCloud, which is a big thing. So they really put this feature, you know, they made it a bit more prominent than it was before, a lot more prominent actually. So Camilla, in your experience of using SoundCloud, do you think this is going to be something that enables a better communication, a one-to-one communication between fans and also between artists and fans?
I wouldn't say between artists and fans, but just general, if we're working, I mean, some of our clients don't use SoundCloud. They refuse to use SoundCloud, which is fair enough. They've got various protocol they have to stick to. But for other stuff, I think it's just going to be easier in general for us to manage those accounts, you know, just to be able to communicate privately with people. Just it makes sense. We don't use it a lot for fan engagement, but we do have some artists that are amazing on there for fan engagement. But they use the public ones, and they, you know, they post along their own songs, like maybe insight into a song, or like maybe how they've done something, or they've made something, maybe even like an instrument they might have used, and then they respond to the fans on the public comments below. And we find that actually has a much better effect than whether or not you can send out a message. I don't know, can you do group emailing? That would be good.
That would be good. I don't think that's possible.
100 followers.
Yeah, no, that would be amazing. But no, it can't happen. I think
you've got no real way of like contacting. You can have 700 followers, but how do you contact those individuals?
I know, DMT has got like 20,900, and I can't. It is quite frustrating.
Just got to hope that they go on and notice you in their feed.
Yeah, exactly. But well, thank you so much. I don't want to make you late for your meeting, but thanks so much for joining us today, Camille.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's great. Thank you. And Andrea, we're going to keep going with you, but I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about this increasing move on direct messages from different services as well that are sort of increasing that, going from a completely shared environment to bringing it back more back into direct messages?
Well, I think that people are... we're going through a process of people realizing that the internet is basically about human beings talking to each other. And allowing people to do that in a way that's useful, I think, is the kind of the key behind that. And the fact that a number of services have kind of got the message all at the same time is an interesting shift, because there is very much that sort of the technology is becoming more transparent. I think that's what it comes down to. It's not we're using the internet anymore. You're performing a task, or you're communicating something to another person. It's like when telephones started to become more normalized. It wasn't I'm using the telephone. It's I'm talking to my friend. And the medium through which you do that became less and less obvious and less and less important in the mix. And so the idea that SoundCloud, which is essentially about sharing types of communication, whether it's music or audio or spoken word or whatever, but it's not, I mean, the point of it is not to go, that is the message. It's rather, here is the thing about which we can have a conversation.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about the internet being a conversational space is, right, here is something. Should we talk about this? Here is something else. Should we talk about that? And I talk about these in terms of social objects, and it can be a YouTube clip or a SoundCloud clip or whatever it is. But when you put things on the internet, essentially it's an invitation to a conversation.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense to me for these sorts of services, whether it's Instagram or SoundCloud, to go, here is a way in which, or a different way in which, you can have a conversation that isn't just about shouting to the world and messaging the same 700,000 people, you know, check out my stuff, I'm amazing, check me out, I'm brilliant, have you heard my new thing, but actually saying, well, let's have some sort of meaningful discourse about this. I think that's kind of, that it makes sense to me.
And on SoundCloud, of course, the conversation is always in public and it has been taking shape as comments on the artist's tracks. So it's interesting to see this movement to bringing it more into a private sphere.
I think the smartest thing SoundCloud ever did was the timestamping of comments. That's really interesting, because it's not just I'm talking about this piece of music. It's I'm reacting to this bit right here. What you did here is really important to me, and that's meaningful. Let's talk about that. And I think that kind of granular subject is kind of an interesting thing to put into a social object. I mean, I can imagine that. I mean, I'm surprised, actually, that YouTube haven't done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it remains to be seen, but more ways of getting people talking about things is actually good for everybody, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And next, I want to talk about Deezer. The company is reportedly having conversations with electronic giant Samsung around a potential partnership.
I thought it was a done deal. I mean, I just skimmed the news headlines this morning, but it looked very much like this is something that is happening. So
yeah, I mean, it's one of those until you get a confirmation, you never know what's going to happen. But
that's why I
like to say reportedly.
It does kind of cover your bases a little bit. Look, it makes sense that somebody with a platform and somebody with a distribution mechanism for music should have a conversation, and that's a sort of a right and meaningful thing to do. I mean, in the grand scheme of who's going to win, is it Deezer, is it Spotify, is it RDO, is it, you know, whatever? A, don't really care. B, isn't that interesting that these people are seeing opportunities by collaborating together? Like massive organizations can go, you could be helpful to me, let's have a conversation. And I think it's not just about, I mean, we've had this narrative of buyouts and takeovers and the rest of it for the last 5 or 6 years. And actually, where you start to get larger organizations going, you know what, let's work together, because I've got stuff that you can use and you've got stuff that I can use. What can we make of this? I think... Yeah. Whether or not that's what comes out of this particular deal, it would be nice to think that this is kind of like a marker that that's the kind of corporate conversation that's going on at this point. But, yeah. I'm certainly not party to those conversations.
There's a couple of things that are interesting. Like on the one side, Deezer's last round of funding was $130 million, but dates back to late 2012. So Deezer might actually be needing to do this new round because, it's a global company. It probably has very high monthly spends as well and on licenses and on salaries too. And the other thing is that it's interesting to see whether Samsung takes the deal, just because we haven't really seen a big... headset manufacturer make direct deals with the streaming services as of late. It's always been carriers driven. And the last, I think the last manufacturer to really take a leap into the space was Nokia with Comes With Music, and that we all know how that ended up.
Yeah.
And even HTC tried a partnership with Beats, which wasn't really music. It was more like a hardware-related thing, but that didn't really work out for them either. So I'm just wondering whether there is a space for... headset to partner with a streaming service and what kind of value that can deliver to either, really?
Well, the obvious answer is you buy a mobile phone, you get a bundled streaming service. I mean, that's I'm surprised that doesn't happen more often. But I think there are more interesting conversations to be had there. And just in terms of the sheer ubiquity of handsets and mobile devices, and increasingly so worldwide. I think that's a really interesting point. And the ubiquity of music through streaming services, the idea that you can access most, if not all music that you want to listen to through these services, and actually kind of pairing up those kinds of, well, we've got a bottomless well of X and you've got a bottomless well of Y, there's a kind of a connection to be made there. But I think it goes beyond that. You could actually do more interesting stuff in this space.
Yeah.
And I think this is a starting point. I think the problem with Nokia Comes With Music is, we put music into a mobile phone, ta-da, and everyone went, so? That's not actually a revolutionary thing to do. But I think if you have those resources at your fingertips and that ubiquity of access and content, then you can start to ask more interesting questions about, right, now what? And I think that it's the next bit that happens once that deal is done that will be kind of the interesting thing. And it would be a shame if people who are, A, that powerful and, B, that smart could not come up with something that will make us all go, wow, wouldn't have thought of that. And that's really clever. And that's the bit that I'm waiting for, and it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, sure. And as a final bit of news, I want to talk about playlist.net. So it announced the purchase of Topsify's playlists. So these include the UK and US top 40 playlists on Spotify, which together have more than 700,000 followers on the platform, which is quite a lot. So this represents kind of a validation, a further confirmation of the value of playlists, which have come under scrutiny in 2013 due to Ministry of Sound's lawsuits against Spotify due to the replication of the Ministry of Sound compilations on the platform's playlists. So, it's a really interesting space because, I think it's the first time they're really seeing a purchase of a playlist in that sense, because essentially Topsify is a series of playlists, not much more than that. And so I'm wondering how that space is going to evolve and whether we're going to see more of this type of acquisitions, which are more, which are metadata acquisitions, essentially.
Yep. Well, I think the Ministry of Sound thing's really interesting because it says that these songs in that order belongs to us. And that's a really interesting thing to say from a metadata perspective, is to say, like, if you arrange things on your shelf in this particular order, that belongs to us. That's our intellectual property. And I never found out what the end of that. What was the end of that that case?
I'm not sure, Asha. I'm wondering if it's still ongoing. And I can't remember talking about it on the show as a resolved thing.
Because it makes sense from both sides. I can understand that somebody puts all that work into putting a compilation together, and somebody just replicates that. But from the point of view of the actual mechanics of that, all I've done is I've written a list. And the fact that my list coincides with your list is nonsensical. But I think the kind of the deeper and more interesting thing for me for playlisting is that this is something that radio has known for a long, long time. Music doesn't just make meaning for people on its own. It makes meaning for people in an order. You know, and the kind of my mission as somebody who DJs from time to time is, what's the best next song to play? And solving that problem for people and solving that question of not just what is the song and is this a song I want to own, but what should be before and after it, and what order should these things go, and building narrative through music with rise and fall, and, you know, building excitement and tension. I mean, you can do that as a DJ on the dance floor, you know, build the crowd up and then have it drop and so on, or you can just do it as a day progresses through, you know, morning to evening, and getting different moods as things go. The idea of playlisting being a way in which people make meaning through music, I think, is a really rich field, because that's the only way in which music makes money. Is if you make meaning for a lot of people, then you can charge them money for it. And I think that this idea that putting music in an order is really significant to people, even though they don't think about it in that way. But how they experience music, and this is why radio is so meaningful to people, is this is not just my favorite song followed by my other favorite song. It was a really good show. And so those sorts of feelings you can develop in that space. I think that's really interesting. Whether this is the right service for that, or, you know, I mean, 700,000 people is a big number, but it's not all of the people in the world by any stretch. And for a lot of services, 700,000 people would represent failure. Yeah. So it depends on what they're kind of what they're aiming for. And again, it comes down to this idea of, if they can make a sustainable business out of that, more power to them. That's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I really like the app on playlists.net. If listeners haven't downloaded it yet, it's definitely one to check out if you use Spotify. If you don't, then it doesn't work quite as well. And I wanted to, this is something that comes back talking about Beats Music. I haven't talked about it this week just because I'm sure next week is going to be all about Beats Music after the launch. But they've announced a list of really big names in the radio and online music world. The blogging world, label world, that have joined Beats to create playlists. So obviously they're placing a high value on that.
Well, I think curation is really important. And I think that Ian Rogers certainly gets that. This idea that one of the ways in which, you know, playlists can be meaningful to people is that they represent a particular person's curation and taste and so on. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Is actually putting somebody in a room that says, I'm going to choose these songs for people, and that's going to be significant. And I think that's something that not a lot of people are doing. For instance, iTunes Genius, for instance, is all about the algorithm. It's about, let's find songs that you already own and put them in a particular order for you that kind of is at least loosely connected. And that's one way of making meaning from a bunch of music and just sort of grouping it. But having somebody sit down and go, you know what, I know music and I know my music, and let me play you songs that are really meaningful to me. I think that's a piece of communication that's really valuable. And I think that's something that it sounds like they're doing right.
Awesome. Well, I'm just going to finish by reading a couple of news headlines that we didn't get the chance to talk about. We can't talk about everything on the show, otherwise it'd be 5 hours long. And to finish up, a couple of quick headlines. Oasis have joined the streaming fold as their catalog appeared on Spotify, Deezer and RDO on Monday morning. So one less streaming holdout out there. Beyoncé's sales have exceeded in 4 weeks of her previous album, 4. Of course, it was released in that sort of secretive manner that made it quite headline worthy. And the singer also penned an essay on gender inequality for the Shriver Report, which is examining the rates of financial insecurity amongst American women. So definitely go and check that out. It's quite interesting to read. And finally, Frozen's soundtrack last week reached the top spot on the Billboard album charts in the US, the first Disney movie to reach the top spot since Pocahontas in 1995. Although it didn't sell very much, it sold 165,000 copies, I think, which is pretty low for number one on the Billboard chart. And already there are rumors of a Broadway adaptation underway, so definitely a successful Disney movie there. And thanks so much, Andrew. It was a real pleasure having you. And again, let me plug musictechfest.org and also your book. So let me just pull up the title once again.
Radio in the Digital Age.com.
And you can also find, there's also, I think I've thrown the links there in the recommendations page on Digital Music Trends that goes straight into Amazon. So if you are on DMT and listening to the show from there, you can head to that page and buy it right away. Thanks so much, Andrew. It was a pleasure having you on.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
And thanks so much for listening. DMT comes out every week, of course. You should also tune in to the DMT one-to-one show, where I interview interesting startups and music tech projects on a one-to-one basis. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week, and until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.